Welcome back to another episode of an Investor's Journey podcast. Usually I try to put these episodes out every Wednesday, but at the beginning of the week, apparently got hit with some cold allergy, whatever the hell's going around. So wasn't really healthy enough to be recording an episode. So I'm a little congested still, but bear with me. The episode's still going to be good. This is going to be episode 23 of An Investor's Journey. And in this episode, I wanted to talk about creating your own list for marketing by driving for dollars. So this strategy is by far one of my favorite ways to create a list because your competition is a lot less. You understand? Like, this is not your typical list, like foreclosures or probates or something that most people have access to and you can buy from anywhere, which is why they get hit so heavily. I mean, pre-foreclosures, last time we used to do them, they were getting hit like 70, 80 letters a month. It was insane the amount of people that were doing pre-foreclosures because you simply buy the list, mail out to them. That's it. But driving for dollars actually requires a lot of time. It requires you to go find these neighborhoods, get out there, drive them. And even then, what's very interesting with driving for dollars is I recently took out a group to kind of show them how we drive for dollars and everything. And at one point, I kind of left them alone to pick out the houses that they would consider distressed. And everybody had different houses on their list, right? So the reason for that is that we all have different opinions of what a distressed home looks like, even though it may seem clear cut to you, thinking that a distressed house is a distressed house. It doesn't matter. Well, we all have different things in our mind that makes a home distressed. So it's very interesting. So it's that kind of helps in making sure that not everybody's list is the same. So that makes it even better when it comes time to marketing, because there may be houses that you're marketing to that nobody else is, because to them, it maybe wasn't distressed enough. Or maybe they missed it. I mean, when you're driving around, like, your head is on a swivel, right? And you might miss things. You might get tired. You might overlook a house. So the variables are there to make it a lot more competitive for you to be able to possibly get a deal out of this. So that being said, the first step is determining what neighborhood you're going to be driving. Right? This is the biggest thing that most people overlook or most people get hung up on. You know, which neighborhood do I drive? I don't know where to begin. So they start overanalyzing and they don't do anything. So you have three ways pretty much to determine for a neighborhood, and it goes from hardest to easiest. The hardest way is the way that we do it. And the reason we do it this way is because it's purely data. It's data driven, so we can determine which neighborhoods are not just the really hot ones, but which neighborhoods are coming up. And the way you do this is you need access to the MLS. By having access to the MLS, what you have to do is in the previous month, download all the actives and all the solds. Then you're going to break them down by zip codes. And once you break them down by zip codes, then you're going to see what the average month of inventory is per zip code to determine which are the hottest zip codes. So if you're in San Antonio, you're in luck because we do that. And we put that out on our market update every single month, which we have one that's going to be probably going out this week, probably Friday or Saturday this week. And we pull the top hottest zip codes and the top worst the bottom 10 zip codes. So we pull all that data ourselves. So you'll be able to do it that way. But the reason we do this is because we get to compare month over month where the trends are going, which zip codes were hot and they're not so much, you know, and then which zip codes we kind of look at the ones that are hot and then the ones around it, because usually when you have an area that's really hot, it starts bleeding over. And also one thing to keep in mind is that just because a zip code is hot, doesn't mean the whole area in that zip code is hot. You can have areas in a zip code that really suck. And the same way that just because and we see this every time we do the market updates, is when we put the top 10 worst zip codes to be in, we see people's face just drop because it's like, ah, shit, my house is in that zip code. But the truth is that, yes, while the overall zip code may be bad, there are still pockets that are probably really good to be in. So the zip code is just one factor of determining hot areas. A really good way to also pick neighborhoods is through networking. Through networking, you can find your flippers, your buy and hold, your owner finance buyers. You can find all of your buyers through networking. Once you find these buyers, you ask them, what areas of town are you interested in? What neighborhoods, what zip codes, what sections are you interested in? And they're going to tell you, if they're real investors, they're going to tell you, hey, I prefer this zip code. I prefer this area. I like this section. And you go writing those sections down and go drive those sections, because those are the areas that you know your buyers are looking at. And at the end of the day, when you're trying to wholesale a deal, or even if you're trying to find deals for yourself, there's a reason why these investors are investing in those areas. Those areas make sense. So if those areas make sense for them, it should make sense for you. It's a better way of determining where to even begin if you don't know where to begin. Just follow where the people are investing. There's a reason they're investing there. You understand? So pull the data. It will take a lot of work. You can, I think, pull 500 records at a time. So, and there's like 9,000 in Sabor alone. So there, it's going to take time to pull the data and do that every single month. If you're in San Antonio, you can just, you know, reach out to us and obviously look at our market updates. Also, just drive in neighborhoods near you. And one of the best ways is to just network and ask people where they're buying, why they're buying there, and then start farming those areas. So now you have, maybe you have a zip code now, right? Somebody wants you to, somebody's very interested in the zip code of 78213, right? In San Antonio, we have a ton of zip codes. So let's say 78213. What you're going to do with that zip code is you go on Google, type in 78213, and then add the word map next to it. There's a link that comes up that I'm going to put it underneath in the show notes. I can't remember it right now, but I think it's like UnitedStatesZipCodes.org or something like that. The good thing with that is that when you type in the zip code there, it actually outlines the section of that zip code for you. And then what you do with that section, you go into your MLS and then you pull up the map to do a search. So you pull up that map and you just do a search for that same section, right? For that whole zip code. And what you're looking to get here, I would even just go as far as searching back 1 month. It doesn't really matter, like, the amount of time. What you're looking here is for the amount of subdivisions that are within that zip code, right? You want to determine what subdivisions are inside that zip code. And again, in San Antonio, we have a ton of subdivisions in just one zip code, right? So you write down all of these subdivisions. Then you go back to the beginning. You go back to your MLS, type in that subdivision, and you want to pull up all the data as from maybe the last month, depending on how much data comes up. You want to exclude any subdivision that houses were built pretty much from, I would say, 15 to 20 years ago and up. Because about 15 years and up. You want to kind of exclude those neighborhoods, because a 15-year-old house, it's very hard to have 15-year-old houses to be extremely distressed and be very torn down where it's going to make sense as an investment. But anything older than that, you have a much better shot. Like, personally, we like being in neighborhoods where the houses were built in the 80s, in the 70s, the 60s, because we know these are older homes, you know? And a lot of times, there's people that haven't done a full remodel on these houses. I mean, new electrical, new foundation, new AC. They haven't done that. They just go patching it here and there. So you have more of a likelihood of them being distressed. So we definitely want to make sure that you're looking for neighborhoods that are old enough to be driving for dollars. Newer ones, you're going to have to test it out and kind of just drive them if that's all you have in your area. Is, you know, maybe at that point, what makes it easy is that it's very easy to spot a distressed home in a new neighborhood, right? I mean, they've had to have beat up that house, you know, all kinds of way throughout the time that they owned it. But that being said, you want to make sure that you're getting older neighborhoods, and you want to make sure that when you run, the reason we do this on the MLS is because we want to see what is the highest house sold in that area. What is that in the highest cluster, not just the highest home, because you have one-offs sometimes on neighborhoods. So you want the highest cluster of homes sold. So what we like to do in San Antonio, the medium price point right now, I think is about 220, which means is that that's a pretty hot price point to be in, right? Those are the houses that are selling. That's that price point of affordability right now in San Antonio. So for us, we don't actually like to buy houses that the ARV, so the after repair value, what we would flip it for, is above 250. Yes, of course, there's a million exceptions to the rules. We always look at numbers anyway. But as a rule of thumb, to be able to pick out these neighborhoods, we want 250, from 150 to 250, right? That's what we select, because that's that hottest zone. These are the areas that, because we pull the data, we know these are the lowest months of inventory, which means if we find a house that fixed up is within this price point, we know that when we put it on the market, it's going to sell fast. You understand? We don't want to hold on to houses too long. Houses don't like to be sitting vacant. They tend to start sabotaging themselves. So you want to make sure that when you're picking out these neighborhoods, you want to stay within that low months of inventory bracket. You understand? And then if you start going outside that bracket, it's going to be more of an educated decision on your part, which this means that you have time in the market, you have education on the market, so you can make that determination, which we have already. We've gone outside our parameters a couple times, but we know the market that those properties are in, and we know our numbers. That being said, we try to stay in San Antonio between that 150 and 250 price point, right? So when you're pulling up these neighborhoods, these subdivisions, you want to look at what's the highest cluster of homes sold. If I see the highest clusters around the 240s, 250s, 260s, that's great. I'll stay with that. You understand? And then when I see the lower end, usually are in the low 100s, that's a good little range in the neighborhood that I want to be in. You understand? And then as a byproduct, what I will do too is, being that I'm already searching that subdivision, is I will look at the rents. I want to see where the rents are in that neighborhood, because I may come across a house that may not make sense to flip, but it makes sense to keep as a rental based on what the values are. So while I'm already looking at the ARVs and the values and all that, I'll pull up the rent as well. So now I've determined which neighborhoods have that ARV between 150 and 250 and what the rents are in that neighborhood as well. You understand? So now I know my data for that neighborhood very well. So when I start driving it, I know what I'm looking for. You understand? Because now by doing that, you're looking at, so what is the full ARV on that property, right? Let's say a 250 property has granite countertops, laminate floors, you know, brand new windows, I don't know, some crazy landscaping, right? So you looked at that. You're like, okay, so this is what an ARV home looks like. This is a home that if I flip it, this is what it needs to look like in this home, in this area. So when you start driving these neighborhoods, which is the next step, so hold on, before we get to that next step. So what you want to do now, you have that data, right? You're going to go into Google and you're going to type in that subdivision. What Google does that's really cool is that it'll pull up, kind of highlighted, that subdivision in the map section. You want to search in maps. So you're going to pull up that section that's highlighted in maps. And you, what we do is we print it out. So let me see. This one's a little faded. I'm going to try to upload one that's a little better. But for those of you watching, you can see. And for those of you listening on the podcast, I'm going to try to upload a link below. So we print it out like that. And the reason we print them out, the reason we pull up the subdivision and then we print it out, is because when we start, you start, let's say on the top road, whichever one it is, you pick which way to drive. And as you finish a road, we highlight the road. You understand? You turn, you highlight that turn. You go to another road, highlight that road. The reason we do it manually this way is because there's been times like in this subdivision that I have right now in my hands, there's a section of the south side of the subdivision that you have roads that are going, you know, east to west, east to west, east to west, but there's an actual break in one of them and it continues on the other side. And what happened was that when we initially drove without using the maps is that we drove east to west, did the whole neighborhood. We were cool. We're like, all right, good. Next thing we know, I don't know why I was pulling comps or something. And then I realized we missed a whole other little pocket of about 7 streets on the other side. And the reason we missed it is because we weren't tracking it. We weren't highlighting these sections that we were driving. You understand? So now every time we do this, sometimes there's a detour in the neighborhood because there's construction, or sometimes you saw, I don't know, another house and you decided to drive to it, or you took a break and went to get a sandwich or something. Whatever it is, highlighting it helps you know where to pick up next time. You understand? When you come back, it helps you know where to pick up. And it also helps you understand if you missed a certain section. You understand? Because sometimes when you're doing the zigzag, kind of like, you know, you're going one red road, you loop around, you go down the other one, loop around, go the other one, you miss the side streets that you didn't hit from going from one road to the next. You understand? And when you're highlighting, you see that. And then you can drive back up. So I'm sure there's apps out there. I'm sure there's some technology out there that might make it simpler. I haven't found one. You understand? And this is the fastest way for me to do it, because on one side of this, I have the map. And on the other side is where I write down the addresses. You understand? So I just take one sheet per neighborhood. And then very simply, you start a neighborhood. You start a street. I don't care what the name of the street is until I find a distressed home in that street. Because I just don't want to be writing down a bunch of street names. It's just the way that I do it. I don't care for the name of the street yet. So I start down a street. I see a distressed home. 310. Great. Write down 310. 315, write down 315. I go writing down all the numbers of the homes that I see that are distressed. Once I get to the end of the street, because I have a list of homes that are distressed, now I look up and I look at the cross street. I try to look at the name of the street and then I write down the name. Just an easier way of doing it, where you're just not writing down a bunch of streets with no numbers to them. You can do it either way. Just again, this is the way that we do it, the way that works for us. So what we initially like to do is when we start driving a neighborhood is we like to drive at least one or two streets to kind of determine the ambiance of that neighborhood. You understand? Because I get a lot of people that they'll come to me and they're like, man, I wanted to write down every single house. The whole neighborhood looked distressed. I'm like, you're probably in the wrong neighborhood then. Because if the whole neighborhood looked distressed, that means that you're probably in the wrong side of town. Nobody's flipping there. Nobody's renovating houses there. You're probably maybe in a lower end, in an end that's extremely distressed. The prices aren't going up. So this is why you want to do that initial research in the beginning of talking to buyers to see where they're buying. So it keeps you out of those, you know, fully distressed neighborhoods. But what you want to do is when you start driving, you want to determine what the ambiance of that neighborhood is, right? So you want to see, what does a cleanup house look like? What does a renovated house look like? Do they have new builds in that area? You know, and then you want to go kind of setting a baseline of what a distressed home looks like. Because the reason the ARV becomes very important is when you start seeing, let's say, whatever the ARV is, let's say it's 180, even 150. What does a 150 fixed up home look like, right? So new coat of paint in the exterior, cleaned up yard, new roof, maybe new windows, you know, whatever that looks like. Okay, great. That's what it is. Now you're driving by and you see a house with an old roof, dated paint, and maybe you have window units on the side of the house and stuff like that. So what you got to think about is, what is it going to cost this homeowner to update their home so its value is that 150, 180, or 200, whatever it is? What will it cost this homeowner to do that? Because the truth is that not many homeowners can afford to update their home to that level so they are able to flip it later, right? Or they're able to sell for maximum profit. So that right there is how we start judging which homes have more distress than others. You know, we start looking at what it would cost a homeowner to get there. Now, as an investor, I'll look at a house and I say, well, it only costs 20 grand, right? Let's say. Well, it costs me 20 grand, but it's not going to cost a homeowner 20 grand. It might cost a homeowner 40 grand to get it to that same level because they don't have the contractors I have. They don't have the experience I have. So they're going to go on Google or Angie's List or wherever the hell they go, and they're going to hire some expensive ass contractor that's going to come in, and they're going to charge them, you know, 2 to 3 times more than what it would cost me to do it. So if for me, I'm looking at it and I'm like, yeah, you know, they're going to need to update the AC unit. They're going to need to update electrical. They need new roof. I see foundation cracks. Okay, yeah, maybe just on that alone, they'll probably have 30 grand. Well, for them, they probably have closer to 50 to 60 grand. So what is the likelihood that a homeowner is going to have 50 to 60 grand to update it when right now they have maybe an AC unit on the windows with cylinder blocks holding the AC unit up? You know, and this is stuff that I've seen. That's why I'm bringing it up. So these are things that you want to look at. So a distressed home isn't necessarily a home that's a teardown. You know, that which is something that I learned from some people, that the way they drove neighborhoods is that they were looking pretty much for teardowns. And not every distressed home is a teardown. The majority of the houses that we buy, if you look at them, they're not complete teardown. But when you get inside, when you start seeing signs of neglect on the outside, a lot of times, 99% of the times, there are signs of neglect. There are bigger signs of neglect on the inside. You understand? So, I mean, because people try to keep that curb appeal as much as they can instead of fixing the interior, because they want that, you know, that home ownership pride and everything, that when people drive by, their homes don't look like crap. But if it looks like crap from the outside, usually from the inside is even worse. So that is something that you always got to keep an eye on. That is always something that you got to keep in the back of your head. Now, if you're driving these neighborhoods and you find a highly distressed home, I'm talking about it looks vacant, it looks like, you know, this house is falling apart, I would definitely mark that house with a star. Because now I want to do skip tracing, cold calling, whatever it needs to do to get a hold of that homeowner. Because that house is all kinds of messed up. You understand? So you want to make sure to put in that kind of work for that house. But for all the other ones, these are houses that you start just building a list on. Because it's no different like a probate list. Just because they're in probate does not mean that they're struggling, they can't keep the house. You understand? You're assuming that there's some financial struggle, but there isn't. They may not be. There's people that they're just going through the probate process and they're going to keep the home. They can afford it. You know, and this is the same case. Just because the house is ugly doesn't mean they're financial ruins. Maybe they just like an ugly house. But you don't know. So that's why you want to build that list up. And you want to just go drive in these neighborhoods. And usually if it's a neighborhood that I really like there are some pockets that I really like, I'll drive them about every 6 months, 12, at least twice a year. I try to drive those neighborhoods, if not a little more frequently, because that things change. You understand? And I already have a list compiled, and then I'll drive it again and I'll compile that same list, or I'll take that list with me and I'll look at the same houses. Which ones should I keep on here and which ones maybe sold or changed or whatever, right? So you want to go keeping that list and keep driving those neighborhoods. So that's the part of creating the list, driving the neighborhoods. I'm trying to think if there's anything that I'm missing. When you're driving the neighborhood, also don't focus just on the front of the house. Try to look at the side and the back of the house, because there's a lot of times that somebody would, like we saw when we went driving these neighborhoods, the front was like, yeah, it looks a little distressed. Then you look in the back and it's a jungle. I mean, the weeds are like taller than the fence. You know, there's garbage back there. There's all this. So it's like they're trying to keep the front as clean as possible so they don't get any code violations. But then you look at the back and it's like, holy crap. You know, like you can tell they're letting that house go. So you want to not just focus on the front, but look at the side. Try to look at the backyard. Best time for driving, in my opinion, is always during the week, and in the week during the mornings. You understand? When most people are working, because you're going to have less traffic through those streets and you're going to be able to actually drive a little slower and actually take a look at these homes. If you drive weekends, you're going to get a lot of dirty looks. You understand? Because you're just this person driving really slow. And please pay attention to traffic when you're driving. You're not the only person on the road. Pay attention to parked cars. Pay attention to garbage cans on the road. Because trust me, you get so distracted looking to the side for a house that you don't realize that there's a, you know, a car parked or a garbage can there, and you might end up hitting it. And you don't want to be vandalizing other people's properties while you're there. And you'll get a lot of people that are just going to start, you know, kind of looking at you weird and giving you all these dirty looks and everything. It's fine. You're not doing anything illegal. If that's the case, just look at them, wave, you know, smile, be polite. What I like to do personally is when I'm doing this, I'm doing this more out of form of leisure, I guess, for me. It's fun driving neighborhoods. So when I see somebody standing outside more in the lawn or something, and they're looking at me, I'll stop and I'll talk to them. And I tell them exactly what I'm doing. I'm like, look, you know, I'm looking to pick up some houses in this neighborhood. You know, this is my name. This is what I do. If you know anybody that might be considering selling, you know, I give great referral fees for you just giving them my information, or, you know, or you giving me a call and giving me their information. You know, sometimes they're nice enough where they tell you, you know what, my buddy down the street has been thinking about selling. And other times they're like, no, I don't know anybody. And that's just it, right? But you don't know if you don't ask. So that's the weekends. But usually during the week, you get to get through these neighborhoods a lot quicker, less cars on their driveways, less cars in the roads, easier to get through. I don't know if you guys are hearing this background noise, but there's construction outside. So I hope it's not interfering with the audio. That being said, so you're driving, collecting all these houses. All right, so now you have the list. I'll try to think if there's other stuff that I like to point out. But so you have this list. Now what? Now what we like to do is scrub the list. So this is why it's tedious. You have this list. Now what you want to do is you want to go to your county's appraisal district, and you want to look up every single home that you just wrote down. You are looking for two things. One, you're looking for deed transfers. I don't want to buy a house that the deed was transferred, let's say, within the last 8 years, right? Because if the deed was transferred within the last 8 years, usually what that means is that the house sold within the last 8 years. That could mean that there's not much equity built up in that home. You understand? Now, there are exceptions like everything. You may have an area that you know that in the last 5 years, it appreciated like crazy. You understand? So you might be willing to buy a house that maybe, you know, the deed has transferred in the last 6 years, 7 years, 5 years, right? That's something that you're going to have to determine on your own. We have sections like that here where I will make those exceptions. And I might look at houses that were deed has transferred up to 2013. Because I know those neighborhoods from then till now have appreciated tremendously. So the whole goal with this is building equity. You understand? You want a homeowner that has enough equity where you can buy the house and do something with it. You understand? If they don't have any equity, there's really not much options you have there, right? So you want to make sure that, you know, usually 8 to 10 years of equity is more or less of a ballpark. And the 8 to 10 is because of the bull market that we've been having. You understand? At the bottom of the market in San Antonio was 2011, 2012. So that was the bottom of San Antonio. And then it's been going up ever since. So that's kind of where I'm getting that 8 to 10 year range. So you kind of got to determine this depending on the neighborhood that you live, the city that you're in, what that's going to look like for you. But we're looking at deed, right? So when was, I want to find those deeds that is going to show that there's enough equity in there. Once you have that, then you want to look for you have the property address, and then you have the owner's mailing address. You want to make sure if those two are different, that's what you want to write down. Because if you start marketing, either cold calling, door knocking, or direct mail, you want to make sure you're contacting the homeowner and not the tenant, right? You don't want to be telling the tenant, hey, I'm looking to buy the house, because it's a waste of time for you. We have done that when it's been hard to get a hold of the homeowner. You know, then we'll go to the tenant, because usually the tenant has access to the homeowner. So that's the only time we've done that. But usually you want to go directly to the homeowner if possible. So you want to look at if the mailing address is different from the property address, and also if the deed is old enough to show a certain amount of equity that makes the deal worth it. So that's how we scrub a list. You understand? So we go through that and we start excluding all the ones that have been sold, let's say, within that time frame that we don't want. You know, any 2017s, 16s, 18s, we start getting rid of all of those because they just don't, there's no equity in that to do anything with. And so we start getting rid of those properties and it leaves us with our list. Now we have a list that we can market to. You understand? And this, you can do whatever you want. Of course, my preferred method is door knocking and then cold calling. And then, I mean, just do direct mail for the hell of it. You know, you already have a list. But what's good about this is, again, you drove a neighborhood, you created a list that unless somebody else drove that neighborhood and has the same taste that you have, they don't have the same list. Then you scrub that list to exclude all the ones that you know are not going to have too much equity in, because all you're going to be doing is wasting your time with those. Now you have a very defined list. Now you can start hitting that list all different ways. You understand? That's where I recommend the marketing. I'm not a fan of the shotgun approach where you buy a vague, big ass list and just start shooting out marketing to everybody. I'm more of that narrow, detail, specific list that I want to hit. You understand? Because then I can dedicate a lot more capital and a lot more effort to that list than I could if I was trying to hit all of San Antonio, let's say. So it makes a lot more sense to go after a targeted list like that. So that's essentially how we do it, how we do our research, how we find the neighborhoods, how we drive the neighborhoods, how we create the list, and how we scrub the list. That's pretty much how we create our marketing campaigns. Those are the properties that then we'll go after and start door knocking and cold calling and doing everything else to try to find the homeowner and see if they're interested in selling their home. So I hope this helped you. Again, thanks for bearing with me. I know I'm a little loopy right now. I've been taking some medicine, so I hope everything made sense. If there was something that you want further explanation or something that just doesn't click, seriously, ask me. You understand? Because I can break things down even further if there's something that's just not making sense. The whole point of this podcast is to share with you guys the things that work for us. So if there's something that's not making sense for you, let me know. I would help you out. I'll give you some guidance and I'll kind of clear up those questions that you may have. You have my email, that's John at primehomes.com, or anywhere on social media, you know, Instagram, Facebook, on our Prime page, wherever, you can get a hold of us. So if you have any questions or anything you feel like I might have missed, shoot me a message and I'll definitely help you out. So again, thanks guys for watching. Keep sharing this with your friends and family, anybody that you feel that, you know, could definitely benefit from this. And I love all the feedback and all the love that you guys have been giving us. It really does mean a lot to us. It's great to be able to help out so many of you. So keep up the great work. Keep the questions coming and I will catch you guys on the next one.